Well, Merry Christmas week, everybody. It's me, Greg Wyshynski. Merrick is not with us today because he is gallivanting around and doing holiday things for family and for company. As usual, when I'm flying solo, Stacked and Packed show today. If you hate me, please stay for Mike Hyka on the Dallas Stars, Ryan Lambert on the World Juniors and the NHL Year in Review, and also Frank Saravelli, our good friend, who is on the show today, obviously, because Merrick isn't, to yell at him about making Ray Emery the first star last year. He will be on to talk about the Philadelphia Flyers and all that good stuff. To start off the show, I think we should probably talk about this Matt Barkowski hit. I blogged about it on Puck Daddy earlier today. There was a lot of contention and derision about why the National Hockey League decided not to suspend him, not to fine him, not to even have a hearing for Barkowski on that hit. And I got to be honest with you, you know, there was a part of me that thought last night and watching that thing in real time, it was going to be automatic. Like, I thought Barkowski was automatic as far as getting at least a hearing last night. But you know what the thing is, though? The more you look at the play and the more you hear the NHL's sort of rationalization on why there shouldn't be a hearing, you kind of get it. And again, this has been my favorite thing about the Department of Player Safety, is the idea that they can have a group of guys in a room, hockey smart people, hopefully none of them with familial ties to the Bruins, and they can look at the play and come up with a viewpoint that maybe in real time, maybe the third or fourth time that you saw it, you didn't consider. So consider this. Should that play have been interference to begin with? Brian Gionta receives a suicide pass from his teammate. We all know this is a thing that puts people in a very prone position. The question of interference is whether or not Gionta actually has what could be called possession of the puck. In this instance, he gets his stick on the puck. He doesn't control it. He lunges forward for it. Barkowski comes through like a freight train and just nails him. Now, what you have here are two different things. Was it interference? And if it was interference, it should have been a five-minute major. That's sort of a 1A. And two, what is the hit? Now, according to the NHL, it's a full-body hit. And I think if you look at the replay 100 times, maybe around 80 times, you'll say, yeah, it's a full-body hit. His head jerks back violently. His tiny little Brian Gionta ragdoll body goes flying through the air like you would, like a child's toy to land on his head. And he's injured. It's a bad scene. The aesthetics were terrible on that play. But if you look at the play, it appears as though Barkowski's going for a full body hit. It also appears as though the head is not the main point of contact. The NHL, by the way, is trying to get away from the word principal, mainly because I think it's misused a lot. So main point of contact. So was it interference? It's a dicey call. And in a bang-bang situation as it was on the ice, you can't fault the official for at least calling it an interference penalty. Even if you can make the case that Gionta was going to have possession of the puck, if not for mitigating circumstances, a bad pass, whatever, there's no way for Barkowski to not believe he isn't going to have possession of the puck at that point. But then the onus is, of course, on the hitter to not lay out the guy if he doesn't have the puck. So I get that. Five-minute major for it, though? That's aesthetics. That is injury on the play. That's a guy flopping all over the ice. That's the Sabres raising bloody hell about the hit in that moment. Foligno going and trying to beat him up. That's an aesthetics call right there, 5 minute in a gamer. And you know what? If the NHL wants to say that's enough on that hit, so be it. It probably is. And we come back to the basic thing that we always talk about with the Department of Player Safety, which is that their job is to further penalize injurious plays if it meant that another team is that now at a disadvantage because the player was injured. And in the case of the Sabres, obviously, if Gionta's hurt, that puts him at a disadvantage. But it's also to police the league to make sure that people are hitting the right way. And I'm sorry. There are mitigating circumstances to the hit that mean that Gionta's head maybe made more contact with Barkowski than was intended on the hit, be it the height differential. It's about 4 inches based on the listed height, I believe, which is obviously not the real height. I think Gionta probably stands about 5'5", maybe, generously. But he tried to hit him with a full-body hit. And if you followed the Department of Player Safety drama on this program since its inception, both the program and the department, then you know that one of the things they've constantly harped on is the idea that you don't lay out a guy with a headshot. You don't go Scott Stevens on Korea or Scott Stevens on Kozlov, or Scott Stevens on Lindros, or Scott Stevens. You don't do that anymore. You try to go full body hit. And if you do that, you get a cookie. And Barkowski, at the very least, tried to do that with Gionta last night. Bad pass, lunging for the puck, a lot of velocity, the aforementioned height differential between the players. All of those are the circumstances that led to the injury and led to the tilt-a-whirl type hit. But at the end of the day, maybe an interference minor. I am no Bruins apologist, ladies and gentlemen. The Bruins fans think that I hate their team. They think I demonize their team more than Flyers fans think I demonize their team. By the way, Frank Cervelli coming up today on the show. I don't. And now Sabres fans believe that the league is picking on them, which I don't think the league does necessarily. I think everybody's an equal opportunity offender at that level, which is, of course, hilarious because the Bruins fans think they get picked on too, despite, you know, the father of one of their players working for the National Hockey League. But he recuses himself, as you know. Recuses. Matt D. writes in, shouldn't have even been a major, but that's a tough call with such a huge blast radius of a pinwheeling Lilliputian. That's good. It's true. And again, I am harder on referees than anybody else on this podcast too, being that there's two of us and one of us is a complete apologist for the Zebras. One in particular. I didn't even get into that shit show that Peel had over the weekend. I had Aaron Portsline, the writer for the Columbus Dispatch, literally reaching out for me to say, have you seen what's happening here in this game with Tim Peel? It's always good. But in that situation, when it's bang, bang, in the moment, and the end result of the play is a guy going skate over sternum, toes over taint, onto the ice, onto his head, there's an injury, and everybody goes nuts. You can't fault the referee for making the call in that moment. It's a bad call, in hindsight. It shouldn't have been a major. But at that moment, in that moment, I don't think you can necessarily blame the referee for making the call. Hard R writes in, hey, imbecile, I know you enjoy writing for a piece of shit blog like Puck Daddy, but you're 100% wrong about the Gionta hit. That's good. Brian F. writes in, you must be this tall to be protected by the rules of the game in the NHL, basically. I don't know, man. Listen, just take off the gold and blue glasses for a second. Everybody you over there, take off your black and gold glasses and just look at the hit for what it is. It's a bad pass to put a guy on the trolley tracks. Barkowski tried to make a good hit. Things went awry. There was an injury on the play. Guy got blown up. But what do you want the league to do? Like, what is the end result of supplemental discipline there? Because a player was injured? Why was he injured? Because of the hit or because of the circumstances leading up to the hit? Because he was in a prone position. Which, again, if we could do one thing, if there's one resolution we can make as hockey fans in 2015, let it be this. He put himself in a prone position does not mean you're blaming the victim. Okay? It means that circumstances led to an injurious play. The hitter made a hit. Maybe it was late. A guy made a pass that put a player in a prone position. Saying a player was in a prone position does not say that the onus is on him for what happened. It just means that there are mitigating circumstances for the play that went down and the way it went down. It's like I've seen people give the NHL boatloads of flack for saying, you know, a player put himself in a prone position. That's just not the case. It's just it's explaining the context of the hit. That's all it is. But I don't know. The question of the day today is we wait for our first guest, Mike Hyka. So Mike Hyka on the Stars, who are putting together a little run now. It's good to see. Then also Lambert, and then also Cervelli. Question of the day today is, who, by chance, deserves a lump of coal in their stocking this hockey Christmas? What team, player, announcer, I've already seen a couple people say a certain announcer on NBC, who are these people that deserve a lump of coal in their stocking this hockey Christmas? PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com, @Wyshynski, @JeffMerrick on Twitter, #@MVSW. We forego the opening intro montage BS to bring in a man who deserves no introduction. So we'll just say he writes about the Dallas Stars. Ah, maybe you need one. Mike Hyka joins us here on the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast to talk about the surging Dallas Stars, winners of 4 in a row, and now 7 points off the pace for the wild card with 2 games in hand. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Doing fine, Gregory. How are you?
Doing fine. First off, let's ask you, what is it like to cover the best goal scorer Dallas has seen probably since the heyday of Mike Modano in Tyler Seguin?
It's been very interesting. You know, because he came with a quote-unquote reputation, you know, that obviously I think that that's going to affect your own opinion of, okay, what is this guy? And it's been just interesting watching him. He's a young kid. He's a little bit brash, but really hard worker and obviously incredibly skilled. And it's been kind of neat watching him. I think Eric Duhacek had a real nice story on him this weekend where he talked about how much he's matured just in the last year. And it's been fun watching him mature.
My theory on that deal, because obviously now we're starting to see the same blowback to the Bruins that the Leafs got, you know, when they made the Kessel deal. My thought is always that this whole new maturity that Tyler Seguin has wouldn't have happened if he didn't have his entire world blown up by Peter Chiarelli and the Bruins. Do you subscribe to that at all?
Yes. In fact, I subscribe to that on almost every trade. I don't think Kari Lehtinen would have made the improvements in his physical stature and in his work ethic had he not had the disappointment of Atlanta and then been traded to the Stars.
Hmm. There you go. So the Stars.
I mean, it makes a big difference in a player, I think.
It does, absolutely. And I think he needed to have a shock to his system before he could become a mature player. And that's why I always say, like, the Bruins, the more this kid scores, and he's going to keep scoring, and he could win the Hart if they rally for a playoff spot, probably would. They're going to get just a ton of shit for it. And I say to everybody who gives Chiarelli and the Bruins all this grief, one, he wouldn't be playing with Jamie Benn in Boston. He'd probably be their third center or playing on the wing. And two, he's not this guy if he's still in Boston running with the same crowd, having to have a chaperone outside of his hotel door on the road. It's just not going to happen.
Well, and I agree with that. The other thing is, I mean, I guess you can't really assume how he would have adjusted there, but I do believe the fact that he is among a group of 20-somethings instead of 30-somethings, mm-hmm. It changes, one, how he looks at things. I think he's protected. Like, if you're hanging out with college kids who don't care if you're a pro athlete or think it's just cool that you're a pro athlete and want to fool around with your phone, that's, mm-hmm. that's one thing. If you're hanging around with teammates who know that you have to be protected, I do think that helps. And then the other thing is he wouldn't have the leadership role that he has here. He really is one of their leaders, and I think he feels the weight of that leadership. So, yes, I agree with you that it would have been more difficult for him to be this guy in Boston.
Let's talk about the Stars. Obviously not the start that they wanted. Goal differential, I think, is still around a minus 14 right now. Last night, a 6-5 thriller against the worst team in the West. Let's just call them what they are. Where is the team? When they were losing, right, the big criticism was on Jim Nill not having properly constructed the blue line before the season. During this little spurt of getting back into the playoff picture, has the defense stabilized at all? Was last night an aberration?
Every game is different. It's been really, like, you can look back a month and say that they actually had a string of 3 or 4 or 5 games where they were better than they have been in this 4-game winning streak. But it's better for 40 minutes or better for, you know, 38 minutes. And then they find some way to unravel at times. So they're just, the inconsistency is there every game. And even in games like Calgary, they got off to a horrible start, and then they kind of brought it back around, and you know, shots were 22-21. They played a good defensive game. So it's been something every single game. On defense, they've changed a lot of pieces out. 4 guys who were here in training camp aren't here now. With Nemeth being injured, then Dylan, Connaughton, and Gonchar are all gone. So, you know, Tom Gillard said the other day, you know, the one thing you can say about this team is they've been inconsistent, and the one thing you can say about youth, generally speaking, is it's inconsistent. And so it kind of follows the path of if you're going to have Klingberg and Yoki Paka and you know, some of the other young guys that they've been trying to put in here, you're going to have some inconsistency.
Yoki Paka, without question, one of the better names in our league right now, for sure, without question. The you mentioned the Brendan Dillon deal, and that was an interesting one. I mean, I think that was financially motivated in some ways, but what were your thoughts when you saw Brendan Dillon getting shipped out? Because they were extraordinarily high on this kid, albeit a year ago.
Yeah, and actually, I don't think it was financially motivated. I know everybody says that because of the holdout, but they signed him to a good contract. They were going to get him signed to another good contract. He's a defensive defenseman, so it's not like you're going to, you know, just spend too much on him. The key was they felt they had that guy. They have that guy in Nemeth. They have that guy in Yoki Paka. They have that guy in Alexiak. And what they were looking for was a right-handed shot who could play in the top four. And they're hard to come by. So when Jason Demers becomes available, they have to give up something good to get him. I don't think they hated, I don't think they disliked Brendan Dillon in any way. I don't think they were mad about the contract in any way. They just thought, okay, we have a left-handed physical defenseman in Nemeth, Alexiak, and Yoki Paka. How are we going to go get some right-handed defensemen? And that's, honestly, I believe that was a motivation for the trade.
A couple of forwards I want to ask you about, guys that are new to the team, and uh-oh, there he goes. We got to get him again. I was actually going to ask him about Jason Spezza and also Elish Hemsky, who Hemsky apparently, according to the roster I have in front of me, is a member of the Stars this season. 2 goals, 29 games, minus 11 for Hemsky, by the way. That is a kick in the you-know-what from that contract. But, you know, Heike brings up a good point, which is that sometimes you have to make a trade based on how your roster's set up. I like Dillon. I think he's got upside, and I think he's going to play well for the Sharkies. But sometimes you have to make tough decisions. Indeed, indeed. Real quick before we get back to Heike, Jeremy Rutherford tweets today that Brian Elliott is on the ice with Jake Allen and Martin Brodeur at Blues practice, and quote, seems to be making enough progress that he could be on target to return soon after January 1. So there's that. Hey, Heike, real quick here. Jason Spezza signs the 4-year extension. Obviously, that's what they're looking for out of this guy when they acquired him. What do you think? What are your impressions of Spezza as a center, and specifically as a center in the Western Conference?
It's been interesting. And you know, I go back to this because we were just up there with Hemsky. I think they're having a hard time finding the right fit. Because if you have Sagan, you know, centering the top line, he's playing 20 minutes. And then if you have Spezza centering the second line, he's playing 18 minutes. You have some defensive holes at center ice. And so, you know, a lot of the times you've seen Sagan with Spezza, and then they bring Cody Eakin on the second line, or they bring Fiddler, or they bring Horkoff, or they bring Travis Moore. And so that's been, and I do think it is a Western thing. They have trouble defending out here on a routine basis when you have to go against the just, I mean, it's just a line of great centers you have to defend against out here, big centers too. And so then that, if you're always worried about defending, that affects your offensive game and that affects your total game. And, I think he's trying real hard. I love his personality. He's engaged. He wants to be a leader. He wants to do all the things right. He's a hard practice guy, but it's been a little bit all over the place in the actual performance. And I think a lot of that spurs from him concentrating on trying to be a better defensive centerman. The fact that he really doesn't have the wingers, you know, he's probably had in his career. Hemsky's struggling, Nichushkin's hurt, Eves, Peverly, guys like that who could be really nice second-line wingers that are all gone. So it's been a process, but I do think he'll finally get it. I love his personality. I love his work ethic.
You mentioned Hemsky, and we're maybe dancing around a little bit here, but to put a point on it, I mean, 2 goals in 29 games is terrible, I think is what he's at right now.
Well, here's a team that needs top six wingers, and that the coach won't put him up there. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, well, that's my question. I mean, you know, knowing that, where his place in the lineup is these days, I mean, is that the way to get him out of this? Or does he have to earn the chance to be a top six winger on this team again?
We had that discussion up in Edmonton, because up in Edmonton, he played in the top six, and he played on the top power play. And there are a lot of people up in Edmonton who will defend Alex Hamskine, say he's really a very good player. They went the opposite. They've scratched him three times. They put him on the third and fourth line. He clearly hasn't responded to that, so I think you can make the assessment that maybe that's not the right way to coach him, or maybe that he just doesn't fit on this team and they're going to have to find a way to move him along at some point in time. But, I mean, they're in the process. They're working, and like I said, Lindy Ruff believes he's pushing the right buttons, and we'll see if that's what happens.
Yeah, it'd be really selling high on Hemsky if they try to deal
slightly,
him right now.
Huh?
Good Lord. Yeah, good. What is that, a sixth-round pick?
They actually have a history here with Donald Audette, who I think they sold after 25, 30 games, and then obviously Avery, who they bought out, basically. You know, they've done it before, different administrations, but the fans remember those guys, and Audette and Avery get brought up in conversations about Hemsky right now.
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, I don't know what input the ambassador of fun. Is that still a position inside the organization? Because I know that's who signed Avery, the ambassador of fun.
It's a one-time position. You serve as ambassador for fun for the rest of your life. So nobody else can ever be the ambassador of fun anymore.
Oh, that's interesting. So, because Brett Hull is currently a member of the Blues organization, right? I think,
correct.
Formally. So that means like Chris Pronger. Yeah, like Pronger, Pronger works for the Flyers and the NHL, and so Hull is the ambassador of fun emeritus for the Dallas Stars, but also works in the Blues front office. That makes sense. I think it's just like
board meetings a year, something like that.
Two more questions, sir. Dallas Stars, like I said, currently 7 points out, 2 games in hand on the LA Kings. Can this team rally to make the playoffs? I think there was probably some question whether that could be the case last week, as late as last week. Do you think this team has it in them to continue a run that could result in a wild card?
Yes, I do think they have the ability to make the rally. I don't know if the math adds up, because at some point in time, all these teams are going to be playing each other and somebody's going to get points, and then it makes it harder to climb. And when you look at Calgary, you look at Vancouver, you look at some of the teams that started really hot and they're starting to slide down. But there's still LA in the eighth spot or whatever it is, and, you know, San Jose and Nashville. And to get into those top eight, it may take 96 points, and that's going to be really hard for them to get.
Oof, yeah, indeed. I think the West right now is an interesting place because you're looking at the amount of injuries Winnipeg has right now on their blue line. I think the real question is, do they drop? How far do they drop? Will they drop? Because now all of a sudden that'll open up that second wild card to somebody else, assuming that the top three in the Central are closed off and assuming that everybody knows that LA is going to probably finish either in the wild card or in that third spot in the Pacific.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's going to be hard. And fans ask me this all the time. You know what they're going to do? They're going to rally and then finish ninth and draft 13th. It'll be a horrible season. No, <I'm just kidding. laughs> They won't be anywhere close to the top pick, but they'll still miss the playoffs.
All right, finally, every beat writer in the National Hockey League has this pet project right now, if they are, in fact, in sort of that non-traditional market place like you are. When is Dallas getting an outdoor game?
You know, the actual game that Dallas will participate in will be in Minnesota. I really believe that. As much as the league is intrigued by Jerry World, and you can open it up, and it does seat 100,000 people, it's just, that's a jump in the shark. I mean, it goes against, although they did it in L.A., so, you know, I shouldn't put it past them. But to me, I think Dallas will be in an outdoor game. I think it will be soon, and I think it will be in Minnesota. That's just my personal view.
That makes a ton of sense, and then we can have the big debate over who gets to wear the North Stars throwback jerseys.
Stars on the right.
Oh, my God. How beautiful would that be? There's a part of me that wants Carolina in an outdoor game just to get the whale back.
That'd
be the best. All right, Mike Hyka, you are the best, sir. Happy holidays, sir. Continue your great work covering the Dallas Stars, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
The brilliant Mike Hyka. Yeah, that's something, man. You think they'd do it? Do you think they'd go to the North Stars throwbacks if they played Minnesota? Minnesota versus Minnesota? Or is the subject too sensitive for a Dallas Stars fan to give up your identity for a game on a national stage when you play the Minnesota Wild? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. Conversely, if Carolina was ever given the chance to play in an outdoor game, let's say, oh, I don't know, they have Connor McDavid on the roster, would they come up with some kind of hybrid logo that combines the whale and the hurricane? Could we have maybe the little whale? What's the whale's nickname? Was it Bucky the Whale? Was it? I forget what it is. Had the little whale inside the swirly toilet bowl and make that the logo for the jersey for their outdoor game. Or just say, you know what, forget it. We'll just dress like the whale for a night. How about this? Here's what we'll do. Here's what we'll do. Hurricanes colors Whalers sweater. Sort of a sinister Nega Whalers jersey of red and black. This next guest is going to be able to give us some guidance on this. Joining us down the line, you know him, you love him, three times a week, sometimes more, on Puck Daddy. He is, of course, Ryan Lambert, who will be doing yeoman's work covering the American journey to World Junior Gold over the next couple of weeks. Lambert, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Doing well. Your thoughts on the Dallas Stars wearing a Minnesota North Stars jersey in an outdoor game in Minnesota and or the Carolina Hurricanes wearing a red and black Whalers jersey if they ever play in an outdoor game?
I think both of them are terrible.
It's the singular charms of Ryan Lambert that we always like to tap into when discussing such issues. Sir, World Junior is coming up. I guess I should first ask you about a story that was broken on this podcast, but also the exemplary new podcast, Junior, that Jeff Merrick co-hosts. Your thoughts on the possibility of Jack Eichel leaving the NCAA for Canadian junior hockey?
Well, it's never going to happen.
But like, Merrick said it will.
Yeah, sure. But you know who's telling him that is people who work for junior teams.
This is true. This is very true. And why do you think they're doing that now? Do you think it's this is a crazy theory. Do you think they're doing that now to try to short-circuit his attention span and put extra pressure on him in the upcoming tournament in which the Canadians will face the Americans?
And where's the tournament happening again?
I believe Sarajevo? Oh, no, Canada, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, I don't know why.
What are your thoughts, your preliminary thoughts on World Junior? I know that rosters have to be set and all that jive. If you had to tell us who the favorites are in the tournament this year, the layman like me who will be watching this tournament on NHL Network and trying to learn all the names as quick as we can, who are the top teams in the World Junior tournament this year?
The top teams are the same as they always are. It's Canada, the United States, Sweden, maybe Russia. And then the rest, they all have good players, and obviously, you know, Finland won it last year, but the odds of that happening again seem extremely small.
How is the Canadian goaltending this year?
Well, I mean, it's probably got a chance to be the best it's been in a while, but, you know, then again, you say that every year, like, oh, this is the Canadian goalie who's going to be able to figure it out, and then he puts up like a 904 save percentage for the tournament. So, you know, it's really weird, like, that it keeps happening like this, and they almost never have good goaltending. It's very strange.
If they have good goaltending this season, does that mean the intense conventions and seminars they've been holding in Canada for the last, you know, 10 years have paid off and they've developed goaltenders better? Because I know that's been a real issue.
Well, it's probably just a result of them banning foreign goalies from the CHL, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Do you believe?
No, I don't
do you
know.
That
Zach Plesalli's good. That's it.
Yes, it's true. It's true. Do you believe that this is Canada's gold medal to lose, and the only reason they would lose it is because all of their good players are already in the National Hockey League?
Well, I mean, you know, that it would be a first if that was the reason why, Greg. But no, I mean, you know, it's them, the U.S., maybe Sweden. Like, those are the three teams, and those are the three teams every year that have a chance to win it.
Now, listen, I know at this point in the podcast it's probably just me, you, and the American listeners. So
sure.
go ahead and tell us why the U.S. is going to win World Junior Gold in the coming weeks.
Jack Eichel and Austin Matthews.
Those are two good reasons, sir.
They're unbelievable. I've seen Eichel live 5 times playing for BU and another 3 or 4 on TV. And this kid is just, like, out of this world great. I also write about college hockey for collegehockeynews.com. And I did a thing where I'm trying to compare Eichel to, like, historic goal scoring. And, like, mm-hmm. if you adjust for era and that kind of thing, Eichel is almost as good as Paul Kariya was when he was a freshman at Maine. And he put up 100 points in 39 games back then. So, yeah, Eichel's really good. I think in the games I've seen, his course, he's, like, above 68%.
Wow. What does he do? Does he just put the puck in his pocket and skate with it?
I mean, more so the thing with Eichel is he has maybe the longest arms in human history. And so, like, if a defender gets anywhere near him, he just, like, reaches his arm out and, like, the defender's 8 feet away from it all of a sudden.
I can literally feel Dikembe Mutombo shaking his finger at you for that boast about the longest arms in human history. It's impossible. As long as Mutombo walks this earth, Eichel cannot have the longest arms in human history.
That's okay, you know what? He's number two then.
Okay, very good.
Let's put him a safe number two.
It sounds like Eichel's pretty good, but I mean, so which one of his parents are from Ontario? Or does he have maybe like an aunt from Ontario?
I don't know. He's from two towns over from me, Greg, so, you know.
Well, that's... in his town, what town is he from in Massachusetts?
He's from North Chelmsford, Massachusetts.
I'm not familiar with it. Is there a section of that town called Little Ontario, by chance?
I there must be, right? I mean, that's the only reason he's any good at hockey at all.
Listen, let me ask you a serious question about World Junior, because you obviously have followed this tournament for many, many years. Where, as an American fan... where do you see it on the cultural radar? Are you happy with its growth? Do you think that it's bigger than the Frozen Four for American fans, or that the Frozen Four is bigger? Where is World Junior on the American fan radar right now?
I think, you know, it's probably maybe not as big as the Frozen Four. I mean, just in terms of not enough people get the NHL network, whereas the Frozen Four is on ESPN every year.
Mm-hmm.
But... I mean, I feel like people, you know, I remember watching, like, New Year's Eve being like, hey, everybody, this party, shut up. I got to go watch World Junior in, you know, 2007 or whatever. I don't know. Whatever the one where Jack Johnson elbowed the crap out of somebody because the U.S. was giving up an empty net goal. Like, that was the first one I really remember watching every game of. And that's, you know, back then nobody was really talking about it. And now it feels like a ton of people are, so we're moving in the right direction for sure.
Right. And then move over to the NHL in the time that we have you here, sir. When we think, 5-10 years from now, we think back to hockey in 2014, what will be your takeaways? What are the things that Ryan Lambert really enjoyed, or the things that are sort of seared into your brain about the hockey world in 2014?
Well, you know, I think the NHL had a very, like, very entertaining 2014. I don't know if it was necessarily great or anything like that, but certainly, like, just the craziest stuff happened this year. The Sharks lost 3 games in a row or 4 games in a row after being up 3-0, and they decided they were going to, you know, tear down the team, but then they didn't trade anybody or do anything different. You know, the Kings going on that run where they went to a game 7 in, like, every single series.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been a really strange year, I feel like.
Well, mumps. I mean, that happened too, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. Everybody got mumps. Like, how, and, you know, I feel like we're still going to be hearing about, oh, yeah, blah, 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 got bumped. Like, 2 months from now, people are still going to be getting the bumps. It's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. You wrote about the LA Kings, actually, in What We Learned Today. And you hit on what has sort of become their signature in the regular season, which is not really giving an F. Just being in it to win it, qualifying for the playoffs by any means necessary, knowing as soon as they can flip the switch. But, I mean, is that really – are they playing with a little bit of fire in trying to do that in the Western Conference?
Well, I mean, you know, the Western Conference is obviously very good. And they're an excellent team. It's so weird because, like, it seems like every year they're at, like, you know, 53, 55% in terms of their possession numbers. But then, like, you look and they're in eighth place. And, like, usually you can say that's because Jonathan Quick hasn't been very good.
Mm-hmm.
He's usually like a 905, 910 goaltender, something like that. And this year he's been great. And they're still only in eighth place. So, it's very strange. And, you know, they've obviously had a lot of problems. Everybody on their defense has been hurt, that kind of thing. But it's just really weird.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I've talked to some of their players over the years since they won the cup out of the eighth seed, and they've all said, you know, it's like they kind of know in the back of their head they don't have to win the President's Trophy to win the cup. And
there
are some, like we talked about on the show before, like with Merrick, like there are some teams like the Islanders back in their dynasty years that have been able to do that, and the Kings just seem to be able to do that if that's their thing. But you look at the standings in the West, I mean, there are so many teams that are going to be hovering around where they are right now. Like they need a little run. They need a little cushion. Because I don't think Vancouver's dropping off the pace. I think Vancouver's a playoff team this year. And we know San Jose is, and we know Anaheim is. And when you've got teams like Minnesota and Dallas that are still going to be, you know, chomping at your heels probably, I don't know, man. I don't think they're in danger, but I think that they could be.
Yeah, they need to definitely figure it out. And it seems like they always do, you know, in the last, like, 30 games of the season or so. They just go, oh, yeah, we're unbelievable. We're going to start winning every game now. Like, I don't know why they don't have that. And I, like you say, I guess it doesn't really matter if they win two out of the last four cups or whatever. But, you know, it's just very weird to me that, like, a team this talented has any kind. Like, they should be able to do what the Blackhawks do every year, which is just be fantastic from October 1st to April 15th every year.
Exactly. Exactly. Finally, Ryan Lambert, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the upcoming Winter Classic between the Washington Capitals and the Chicago Blackhawks, currently being chronicled on Epic's NHL Road to the Winter Classic, episode 2 tomorrow night. What are your thoughts about this epic meeting of traditional rivals?
Well, Greg, you know how I feel about outdoor games. They're great, and there aren't enough of them.
This is true, especially when they feature traditional blood rivalries like the Chicago-Washington rivalry.
Yeah, I mean, look, anytime you get a chance to get an original six team and the Washington Capitals together, you got to take that opportunity and run with it.
Arbitrary six, as you know, from Merrick on this show. I mean, it's going to just be, it'll be a fun game, I'm sure, but obviously I don't think here are the two truths in life right now, Ryan Lambert. There is more buzz about the Kings and the Sharks in their outdoor game than there is about the Winter Classic, and there is more buzz about the Suicide Squad movie than there is about Batman v Superman: The Dawn of Justice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know anything about what Suicide Squad is at all, but yeah, I mean, I'd much rather watch a King Sharks game than a non-conference Chicago game.
Finally, Ryan Lambert, as you know, if you follow Two Line Pass on Twitter, and by the way, I'm about to tweet out, if you want to play along with it, Lambert wrote, and I don't know if you're updating this or not, but your Canadian Junior Jingo game, which is like a bingo game while you watch the games. I don't know if you're updating it, but I'm tweeting out last year's game on the old Twitters, and thank you for Martin for reminding me of that. But as you know, if you follow Two Line Pass on Twitter, he is a bit of an aficionado of music. Sir, what was your album of 2014? If you were going to go all Pitchfork on us for a second, what was your album of 2014?
My number one album of the year was Run the Jewels 2.
That seems to be high on everybody's list. Is that something I should pick up?
Yeah, it sure is. It's really, really, really great. I'm not the biggest hip hop guy in the world. I have artists that I like, but I don't get really super dialed in with it, and I'm not super familiar. But you know, I picked up Run the Jewels 1 last year, and it was very good. And Run the Jewels 2 is even better.
The last hip hop album I think I purchased was Young Black Teenagers Tap the Bottle, around 96 or 97. Has rap gotten better since then?
It's a little better, but not a ton. I mean, you know.
I've heard a lot about that fellow that married the Kardashian girl. I wonder if I should pick up some of his albums as well.
Yeah, he's okay, I guess.
Okay. Ryan Lambert, you're a gentleman and a scholar, and thank you for joining us again on this podcast. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas,
and we'll talk to you again.
We'll definitely have you on during World Junior so you can talk to Merrick and explain to him why Canada is struggling.
Well, I mean, once Jack Eichel defects mid-tournament, it's not even going to matter.
Oh, man, you are so steep. Were you legit pissed when he started floating that idea? Because Nate Yule was. Nate was legit pissed.
It's the same thing every year. Oh, this guy is going to jump to junior. It's better for your development and all this stuff. And, yeah, okay, maybe, like, for some guys. But it's not like college is bad for development. And, I mean, the thing I always say is look at Charlie Coyle. He was, like, less than a point a game at BU, goes to the QMJHL midseason and starts putting up, like, a point and a half, 1.75 points a game. And it's like, okay, well, if Jack Eichel goes to that league, then you're just going to have a bunch of Quebec teenagers crying every night because he's going to put up 4 points a game.
And you don't buy the theory that he feels like he needs to outshine McDavid on McDavid's own turf? Because that was another big theory from Merrick.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he's super worried about it. He's leading the nation in points playing against 25-year-olds. He's going to be terrified of what Connor McDavid's going to do to him.
All right. I'll see you later, Lambert. Thank you, Ben.
Okay. Later, bud.
So, Ryan Lambert, ladies and gentlemen, bring in the knowledge, bring in the smarts about junior hockey, the National Hockey League, and everything else. You know, there was a bit of pushback, let's say, on Merrick talking about Eichel going to Canadian Junior. Yeah. It's pretty funny. You know, honestly, I didn't think about the timing of things until Lambert brought that up. It is a little odd that rumor would seem to poke its head up right around a time when there's a giant tournament being played in Canada and the best American player's name is being linked with deserting his program for Canadian junior hockey. The timing is interesting. Speaking of McDavid and Eichel, by the way, I checked the standings right now, ladies and gentlemen, and I see this in the Eastern Conference. I see Montreal, Tampa Bay, and Detroit in the Atlantic. I see Pittsburgh, the Islanders, and the Rangers in the Metro. The Leafs, despite some torrentially titanic, terrible losses in their last few, have the first wild card, and the Capitals temporarily have the second wild card until Boston gets really rolling. Way down, 8 points out, and they are giving away 3 games to the Capitals. Are the New Jersey Devils a minus 25 goal differential? The Devils right now are a point ahead of the Buffalo Sabres. I have not made the declaration yet formally, but I am very much thinking that keep Pete DeBoer on, keep all the old fogies, and tank. Joining us now on the line, beat writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, a friend of the program, friend of mine, I don't know about Merrick, Frank Cervelli, joins us to talk about the Philadelphia Flyers. Frank, you've seen the Devils this season a few times. Don't you think it would behoove them to just throw in the towel and do the job that they didn't do when Mario was available in the draft many, many years ago?
I mean, I keep hearing the word tank, but like this really isn't the NBA. I mean, thing is, even if you finish in last place, there's an 80% chance that you don't get Connor McDavid. So, I mean, if you look at the numbers, I'd have a hard time doing it myself. But, I mean, he is a generational talent, so they say. I haven't really seen him too much. That's why I'm really looking forward to the World Juniors to get a chance to watch him. But, you know, it's one of those things. 80% is a really high number.
Yeah, and but I think the thing is that the draft this year is so deep that even if you get second or third, you're going to wind up with a talent that could be a if not a generational talent, at least a foundational talent. And as a Devils fan, I look at that team and I say to myself, what's the direction? I mean, once the old checks fall by the wayside, you're left with Zajac and Henrique up the gut. You're left with some real good young talent that may not be NHL ready from a every night making a different sense on the blue line. And you have Corey Schneider. I'm like, they need that guy. They need an Eichel. They need a McDavid right now to kind of give that franchise some identity or some direction.
I think they need it, but I'd imagine that they, just judging by their history and what Lou has done, I would just think that before that even happens, that they'd fire DeBoer, but that's just me.
Yeah, it's possible. The Flyers were a team that everybody thought would be in the Derby. They still kind of are. I mean, they're only 2 points up on the Devs with two games in hand. But, you know, you get the sense that there's something here. I mean, the way that Voracek and Drew play, when Mason's been healthy, they've gotten good goaltending. I mean, is there a sense that this team might have a streak in it and can get back into this thing? Or is there a sense that it's just sort of put together by spit, tape, and prayers right now, and that's why they are where they are in the standings?
I have such a hard time judging myself, and, you know, it's kind of ridiculous when you think about it that Segan had a three-point night last night, I believe, and he jumped back into second place in the scoring race. But if Segan didn't have 3 points last night and Giroux and Voracek do what they do, the Flyers have the number one and number two scorer in the NHL today, and they're still in 23rd place in the league. And part of me thinks that they have a streak in them because of that. But the other part of me, when I see games like the two that they had last week against Florida and Tampa Bay, thinks that they're just kidding themselves, because there's just guys, a handful of guys on certain nights that for whatever reason just don't show up. And usually it's sometimes it's been their entire second, third, and fourth lines on occasion. And that doesn't even scratch the surface on the issues that they have with their defense. But Craig Berube really seems to believe that their defense is getting better. He thinks their entire defensive zone play is almost light years away from where it was even a month ago. And, you know, I do see games like this weekend against the Leafs and Jets and think that they have a run in them. I mean, if you look, I think Sarek Locke from Sports Illustrated pointed out today that on this day last year, the Rangers were 6 points out of a wild card spot. And today that team is the Flyers. So I guess it's not necessarily out of hand. But, I mean, just 2 weeks ago, they were at that point where the tank question was being asked of Ron Hextall.
Yeah. Well, and the Rangers, I think at that point, I mean, Nash was probably out. And if memory serves, Lundqvist had kind of a shitty first couple of months. So, I mean, obviously, when you have Lundqvist turn it on, you're going to be able to turn your season around. Which brings us to goaltending. And now I've seen Mason a few times this season, and I've seen him play really, really well in defeats. What's been your take on Mason? And tell us a little bit about Mr. Zepp, who played last night.
Well, I'm going to start with Zepp because, to me, that's like one of the best stories I've covered in my 6 years on the beat. He's a guy that no one even paid attention to really in training camp. And, he's one of those guys that I just kind of was hanging around the locker room one day, started chatting with him and started, hearing a little bit about his story. And he's the most humble and unassuming guy. There's no pretense at all with him. And, he was just really looking for a chance. And he obviously had a great thing going in Europe. He was really comfortable. His family really enjoyed it there, so it wasn't like he was, you know, pushed to move back to North America for any reasons like that. And he, you know, came here, and I guess if you're a goalie and you're looking for an opportunity, the Flyers are the team to sign with, because he was the 11th guy to suit up in uniform for them since 2010. And so he played last night, of course, and picks up the win. And, you know, you can go through all the historical parts of it, you know, being the oldest guy to start and win his debut in 88 years in this league. And to me, I think that was the happiest I've seen the Flyers locker room in probably 2 years. They were thrilled for Rob, and I think his story is one that not only can't help but make you smile, but I think it resonates with every guy in that room, even from guys like Vinny LeCavalier, who have been in this league since they're 18 years old. You know, guys like Giroux, all the way down to the guys that are still trying to break through. So they really wanted to win for him, and I know that sounds cliche, but I think maybe you saw a little bit of that in the third period against the Jets last night.
And as far as Mason goes, what's his story this season?
Well, he started off so poorly. I mean, his first five games or even seven games were terrible. And I think Berube said that he just wasn't in sync with the defense. Maybe he had a tough time adjusting to a couple different things. And the last 20 games or so, whatever he's played, he's been phenomenal for this team. His save percentage has gone from 870 at the start of the season to he's over 920 at this point. And he really has been the backbone of this team. If you look at it, the Flyers' most lopsided defeat this season, I believe, was 4-1 in Chicago, and they had their doors blown off that game. Even you look at all the possession stats and everything, and the score could have been 7-1, 8-1, no question. The Blackhawks had that many chances, and Mason has really stood tall, and I think he's the guy that perhaps makes this team a little polarizing. He adds to that polarizing effect, as I was saying, because it's hard to figure out, you know, exactly where they'd be if his play bottoms out a little bit or perhaps even regresses to his career averages. He's been pretty good so far, and it sort of adds to the intrigue with this team.
It certainly does. What have you learned about this team based on their defense this year, their blue line? I think that was what everybody figured was going to be the most maligned part of the lineup coming into the season. Obviously, they've had to deal with some unfortunate injuries and stuff, the team and thing being at the forefront. But what have you learned about their defense, not only this season, but maybe going forward?
Well, I mean, I think the best way to describe it would be porous. it's, you know, they have a couple guys that have actually surprised the heck out of me. Nick Schultz is a guy who has totally revived his career. He's actually been one of the Flyers' best defensemen so far. And I think if you're a fan of another team listening to the show, and Schultz played for your team, namely Edmonton, Columbus, or Minnesota in the last couple of years, you're probably laughing. But he's actually steadied things out. Michael Delzato is certainly not as disappointing as his healthy scratches would lead you to believe. Last night was his eighth time being scratched in 10 games, a run that he didn't even see in with the Rangers or with the Predators last year. So his career is sort of, you know, hitting the bottom as we speak. This is rock bottom. And to tell you the truth, he really hasn't been that bad at all. I thought he was. Even Craig Berube said he was their most consistent defenseman, I'd say, through the 20-game mark of the season. And all of a sudden, now 10 games later, he was out, and then it sort of spiraled from there. The Flyers started playing a little better, and he stuck with the same lineup. And, you know, overall, though, I'd say that this team needs help. I mean, this team and Ron Hextall's plan hinges on all these draft picks that they've stocked up on. Sam Moran, Shane Gostisbehere has been out with an ACL injury.
Yeah.
You're going to see Moran in the World Juniors for Canada. Travis Sanheim was one of the last players cut from that Canadian team. He's only 18. Robert Hagg is in the AHL. So all those guys are in the pipeline, and I think they're just waiting for these contracts to be up on some of the guys that they do have now, like Braden Coburn and Nick Grossman and maybe even Luke Shen.
And let's talk about one more guy briefly before we call it a conversation here. Vinny LeCavalier. So he scores a couple, right? What's the deal? Like, are they going to find a taker for him? What is the future of Vinny in Philly?
Well, it's tough to say because I don't know of any team that wants him, to be honest. And it's really, I think even if the Flyers were to eat half of his salary and half of his, you know, for the remainder of his term, which is another 3 years after this, I don't understand, you know, who's going to grab him at that point. I know that his salary drops off, and that might make him attractive for a team that's bound for the playoffs, hoping that they can, you know, add a scoring touch at the last minute, probably without even giving up anything significant for sure. What's his future here? I don't know that he has one, to be honest. But, you know, that fourth line was their best line by far last night against the Jets, and that's been a big thing for this team.
Indeed. All right, man. Right now, what's your gut tell you? This team make the playoffs or miss the playoffs?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I'm saying, right, what was your gut tell you right now? This team make the playoffs or miss the playoffs?
I think this team ends up making the playoffs just because of that scoring touch that I mentioned. They really can put the puck in the net when they need to. And if Craig Berube believes in what he's been saying, that the defense has been better and it's going to continue to get better based on the system that he's preaching, then I think that they might be able to sneak in as either the second wild card or the third team in the Metro.
Interesting stuff. Frank Saravelli, sir, Merry Christmas to you and yours, your little one, all that. And we will talk to you soon and see you soon, sir.
All right. Thanks for having me.
The great Frank Saravelli, ladies and gentlemen, breaking down the Flyers as only he can. Question today was, of the day, as it were, who deserves a lump of coal in their stocking? Clark Aitken writes in, it's not that Dave Nonis deserves a piece of coal this Christmas. In fact, back in January, Dave Nonis told the board that he would probably receive a lump of coal this Christmas. But the fact remains that this is a lump of coal that Dave Nonis, even though he's technically been here making decisions since 2009, has not had a lot of time to progress into a new toy. And while the analytics, which Dave Nonis firmly believes in despite all quotes and evidence to the contrary, say that Dave Nonis probably deserves a piece of coal, we need to be sensitive to the fact that Dave Nonis doesn't have a lot of cap room to improve that piece of coal, although he signed all the contracts, and hasn't got the development he needs out of certain players. Even though Dave Nonis blew all his cap space because of one aberration of a season, this is still a rebuilding effort, and while the lump of coal this Christmas isn't where Nonis and the board want to be, Dave Nonis needs a lot more time to turn that piece of coal into something worthwhile. And if things have changed within a few months, I'll simply pretend I didn't say any of this and completely rewrite the story unless some anonymous bloggers are getting famous off of this. That is a long and accurate depiction of the world that is Toronto hockey. Other lumps of coal, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Campbell, Paul Holmgren for trying to anchor around the Flyer, for tying an anchor rather around the Flyers right before getting kicked off the boat. It's too true, man. Martin tweeted this in before when Saravelli was on. $14.1 million against the cap on McDonald, LeCavalier, and Umberger through 2017. That's brutal. That's brutal management right there. Dave Lembo, I'd say Voinov, but a solid piece of coal in a stocking could be used to hit somebody. Oh, that's terrible. But Voinov definitely deserves coal. We're putting together a lot of lists, and the Voinov thing is going to make a lot of them. In fact, the People of Controversy list, I think, is today on Puck Daddy. But Voinov is, Jesus. Joe Pack writes in that Dave Andrychuk was called Clyde from Every Which Way But Loose for his long arms. That's in relation to the Jack Eichel has the longest arms in history. Jeff Peppers, couldn't Dallas, Minnesota each borrow a color from the North Stars and combine it with their own colors, making it a mutual homage? That's an interesting thought. I don't know. I'd still like to see the North Stars return to face the Minnesota Wild would be the thing that I'd want to see. Patrick Clark, something nautical themed, almost Moby Dick-like for a Canes-Whalers matchup. I love this idea of taking the defunct teams and incorporating them into the current jerseys. That'd be pretty good. All right, I think that's the show. Sorry about that Voinov tweet, by the way. I started reading it, and I didn't realize where it was going. It's happened sometimes. There's nothing funny about that, obviously. Chris Erickson writes in, Jeff Vanderbeek forced Kovey contract, which hamstrung the roster, then couldn't sustain, so we lost our top forwards. And now, dot, dot, dot. Yeah, but you know what? The Kovey contract was not infinitely terrible. I mean, as far as a cap hit perspective. Signing Kovey, I think, was problematic insofar as keeping Parise. I still think that had influence on him leaving. The fact that he's a top left wing on the team, and then you trade for another left wing, and then sign him for whatever the hell it was, 17 years. Michael Raphael writes in, the mumps deserve a coal in the stocking. And Mark Cole, how else could we possibly end this bit than with Mark Cole? Actually, Taylor Sullivan, the Penguins medical staff for the obvious mumps situation and also for whatever is happening with Olli Maatta's shoulder. But the great Mark Cole writes in and says, Cole, for you and Jeff Merrick for not killing Game Show Friday. I say again, Game Show Friday lives on, will live on in 2015. It has made a comeback. It's perhaps the greatest comeback. the greatest comeback that we've had here in hockey. It is possible, ladies and gentlemen, that it deserves the Bill Masterton Trophy for greatest comeback this season. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you. And happy holidays. If we don't talk to you in the next couple days, there's a chance we might not. And Merry Christmas, everybody. We'll see you soon. Bye. Oh, Merry Christmas to you as well, producer Matt. Bye, everybody.